I think in addition to a commitment to fairness, I just have an incredible commitment to knowledge. And if I don't know something, I try to figure out how I can learn about it. If
I'm
very
comfortable not knowing.
Extremely.
We're all aware.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I'm Akash.
I'm Arjun.
And we are here with our most enthusiastic guest ever, judging by the mic check, Judith Williams. Judith Williams, say what's up.
What's up?
We should more properly introduce Judith. Judith is the person responsible for us being at South by Southwest. She is works at Dropbox. Can I say your title or no?
Sure, go ahead. All right. Say the title.
Global. I just like that it's global. It just sounds so fancy. The global head of diversity at Dropbox.
That's correct.
And remember, we love Dropbox. Fuck Box.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys remember that, but if you take anything from this podcast, it's that fuck Box. Bring us back to South by Southwest next year.
But we wanted to bring Judith on because, or we wanted to bring you on, sorry, I don't know why I'm talking like that. We wanted to bring you on because, one, we had a really interesting conversation around diversity and around race, and I think that, you know, just walking around your walking around the office here, there's something that feels incredibly collegiate about that. And just when did the start of the push for diversity in the corporate come about? What is the thought process behind that? Love if you just walk us through that.
So diversity in corporate settings has been an ongoing conversation for a long time. It actually comes out of 60s civil rights movement, legislation, once you get the Voting Rights Act, and you start having people say, it's not enough for us to vote. We have to have access to education. We have to have access to jobs. It's beginning in the 70s and the 80s. We have the affirmative action conversation, and it moves forward from there. And diversity changes. Initially, we're thinking about compliance with the law and laws that are changing to include more women, more people of color, people from different backgrounds. Now that we are a bit further along in the conversation, certainly we have equal employment opportunity laws that we still need to comply with, but that's really just the basics. Now we're thinking a lot about how do we make sure that we have opportunities for everyone, and how do we think about diversity as a driver of innovation? And also, how do we make sure not only that we have people from different backgrounds, but we create a culture that's open to them, where they can be successful, where they can have long careers?
So it's almost not enough just to hire people of it. You also then have to create an environment where they can then succeed, rather than having to be forced to assimilate into whatever culture that's there. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think we need to think a lot about the culture that we have. And some companies talk about culture fit, and they look to hire for culture fit. I think it's a lot more important that we think about what is the culture contribution that individuals can make. And coming from different backgrounds, people can make different types of contributions. We want those different types of contributions because that's where we get the value of diversity. When people bring their uniqueness and their skills and their experiences, and they feel as though they're included, so they can share all of those. They don't have to cover who they are.
We were talking with Justin before we met with you to start this podcast, and I was excited to hear that one of the things he was talking about was, you know, diversity. There's a not just ethnic and, you know, gendered diversity, but he was also talking about diversity of schools that people are coming from, which is exciting to me because a lot of as I'm working with diversity and as I've been thinking about it, diversity of thought becomes really important as well. Can you speak to the challenges that come to getting people from different schools, especially in the tech culture? Mm-hmm.
So if we think about how a lot of tech companies grew up, they start because they're a couple guys, and it's almost always a couple guys, who have a really great idea, and they are within one another's network. And they then hire people that they trust. And usually in our networks, we have people who are like us. And so these companies, they grow up with people referring people and referring people and referring people. And they look up. And their companies grow up and they find they're not that diverse. They're not that many women. They're not that many people of color. And even when they do have women and people of color, they often come from the same educational background, the same several schools. So we're in Silicon Valley. We're in the Bay Area. And we see a lot of Stanford folks. We see a lot of MIT folks. We see a lot of Ivy League folks. So it's important to think not only about what people's cultural background is, but what their educational background is, because that means that they have different tools. And if we, for example, are able to hire Stanford grads from every single possible flavor, we still have just hired one way of looking at problems and solving problems. It's important that we think about what other schools of thought are there and how do we do outreach. So the important thing is to move beyond our primary networks and say, how do we broaden that outreach? And then we have to make sure that as we are defining the qualifications for any role, that we're thinking about what does it truly take to be successful at the job, not what are the qualities that may seem more like the folks that we already have.
What are the questions you'll ask, or what do you look for, or that are the things that say, okay, outside of just this looks good on paper, this is a guy who would help our company, even if he's not from an Ivy?
A lot of it has to do with what is your track record of accomplishment? So what have you done already? Okay. And so if we know that, for example, if we're looking at technical employees, if we know that you've built amazing apps, if we're looking, for example, for a mobile developer and you've built already mobile apps, that's going to be a sign for us. If you are able to solve problems in innovative ways, that tells us. And when we interview our technical staff, we ask them to actually solve problems so that we see the way that they think. And so it's ultimately very clear what people can and can't do. In non-technical fields, we ask them about things that they've done. So let us know a time when you've had to work with people of different backgrounds or how you solve those types of conflicts. Let us know a time when you've had to use your analytical skills to break down a problem. So we ask them to walk us through things that they've already done. So interviews can help a lot. We get a lot of signal from that.
How receptive do you find when you are trying to implement new policies that will help with diversity? Is there, I guess, one, how receptive? And then I guess the second part of that question would be, what are the main obstacles that you find to getting to the goals of diversity? And is there an end goal for diversity, or is it just going to be a constant evolution towards further diversity?
So we want to make sure that our internal population reflects the external labor market. And that's a first step. We also want to think about what are the things that we are doing to positively change the labor market. So if we look at the number of women who go into computer science, that percentage has been pretty consistent. About 24-25% of our CS grads are women. So we also want to think about, can we partner with organizations that are actively looking to change that and increase the number of women and people of color so that the labor market supply actually grows? So it's an ongoing conversation. It's not about having enough diversity. It's about being reflective of the diversity that we live with. And it's not just about the diversity you can see. It's about, we like to think about two types of diversity. There is the inherent diversity. Those are the things that I'm born with. Things like my gender, things like my ethnicity, but there's also the acquired diversity. What have I learned on my journey? Where have I gone to school? What kinds of experiences have I had? And honestly, when we say we're trying to hire the best people for the role, it's really the acquired diversity that we want to have expressed and that we're looking for.
Well, it sounds like you're going further than just wanting, because if the labor market reflects 25% CS grads are women, but it sounds like you're just speaking to wanting to expand that number. So that seems to be a step beyond. Am I right in my...
Well, I think we do. We do want to see that number change.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and so, you know, if we think about what we're doing here, is we're inventing the future. All of the tech companies are inventing the future. And we have to ask the question, who are we inventing that future for? I would like to believe that we're going to invent a future for everyone. So it's important that opportunities be available for everyone.
Is that a shared philosophy? Or are you? How much of the majority or minority feels the same way you do?
I couldn't put a number on it, but I think most people
feel... Judith, man. You're real formal right now.
Have heard you go in.
You know, the way I look at it is, aspirationally, if you ask people, do you want to invent a future for everyone? I think there are going to be very few people, although there might be a few, who will say yes. You know, who won't say yes. Most people will say yes. We want to invent a future for everyone. Practically, what that means, when you ask people to challenge some of their deeply held assumptions, then it becomes harder. So people have to hold different ideals in tension. And part of it is getting people to either be comfortable with holding their ideals in tension or being able to flex some of the things that they think are deeply held. And so I think most people are like, yeah, absolutely, future for everyone. Practically, a lot of people perceive it as a zero-sum game. So when they hear diversity, right, they hear a loss for themselves as opposed to an expanding pie for everyone.
How do we combat that? Because I feel like I experience that when I talk about diversity, even when it's just within like Hollywood or acting or stuff. I can feel that zero-sum game underneath. How do you combat that without, or combat might be the wrong word, but how do you address that?
I think you have to address it, right? And I think that as human beings, we have a very strong tendency toward loss aversion. No one wants to feel like they are losing something. So if you have a group who feels like they're going to lose something, that is a real perception for them. I think what we need to do is to look at the conversation from a perspective of abundance rather than scarcity, which is that by having greater innovation, by having greater diversity, we actually are making it better for everyone. So rather than thinking about a loss for those folks, they should think about it as an opportunity to grow, to expand, to find new markets, to find new ideas, to make the pie bigger rather than getting smaller slices of the same pie.
But how do you get them to see that? I'm not even lying, looking for a playbook from you.
I don't know that there's a single playbook, but I think that they're really interesting examples. And I was at Google for a long time, and Google is pretty well known as owning search. And search has been fantastic for Google. And Google is really concerned with finding their next billion users. One of the things that we know is that the next billion users are not going to be found where the last billion were. And so that means that you have to understand what is happening in the African continent. You have to understand what is happening in the Indian continent. You have to understand how to reach different populations. And what we've done so far, it may or may not be as effective. It's likely not going to be effective. So we need to have people who are thinking in different ways, different ideas, if we're going to crack that kind of next vista, those next users. So again, that idea that there is this abundance out here, there's this opportunity, and we're looking at diversity as one of the drivers of innovation that gives us access to it. And I think about when I was at Google, there was a software engineer, and he was a Brazilian software engineer. And one of the things he said really stuck with me, which is that at Google, we were always focused on building the absolute best form of Android for the most expensive phone. But the reality is that most people throughout the world aren't using the most expensive Android phone. They're using cheaper feature phone. So we were essentially seeding a huge marketplace to whatever company was going to build an operating system for that type of phone. Now, why would you willingly give that up? Because you're asked, and what he said was, it's because we keep trying to solve middle-class problems for middle-class people. We need to be able to think differently about who else's problems we can solve. There's great opportunity there.
There were two points to the diversity you were talking about, not only the hiring, but within the culture, within the company. Can you speak to some of the things that you, some of the programs or practices that are in place to assist that aspect of the diversity?
Internally, we, like many other tech companies, we did unconscious bias training. And unconscious biases, I like to think about unconscious biases as blind spots that arise because of errors in the way that we process data. And bringing an awareness to that.
If you guys can't tell, Judith is much smarter than all of us.
I mean,
you included.
Say that again.
I think of unconscious biases as blind spots that arise because of errors in the way that we process data. And so if you think about this, we have a lot of data coming at us all the time, and we are
like, when people say processing data and unconscious biases in the way that we process data, that's a lot of data coming at me right there.
It's a lot of data. But we, in order to be able to make decisions, be able to function, we have to be able to process a lot of it unconsciously. What we need to do is think about when some of that unconscious processing is actually leading us to make a less objective decision, especially about other people. And so unconscious bias training is something that we've done here. We did it at Google. Lots of tech companies are doing it. And then unconscious bias training is the first step. Awareness isn't enough. It actually doesn't do enough to combat unconscious bias. Some would say it doesn't do anything at all. But you can then say, well, what are the things we need to do? What are the key decision points where bias plays out? And how do we create frameworks that help us get around that bias? So how do we make sure that we have better job announcements, so we're very clear about the kinds of qualifications? Interestingly, about data, if you look at who applies for jobs, women don't tend to apply for jobs unless they think they have 100% of the qualifications for a role. Whereas men, if they're at about 60%, they will apply.
That's so real. This is when I was pre-med, I don't know if you can speak to this and what the psychology is behind it, but like I would have female friends who would do really well on these MCAT practice tests, and they'd be like, I'm not ready to take the test. And my male friends would be like, who gives a fuck? I'll get a 4 out of 45. I don't care. Whatever. I'll just take it again. And that was, it's something I've noticed through genders, and I never understood what that was, and I've asked, and nobody really had a good explanation. You seem like you would have explanations for everything.
I don't know if I have an explanation for everything. I think for women, the cost for failure tends to be higher, in that in the Valley, we hear a lot about having the opportunity to fail. That's how you learn.
Yeah.
But who gets to fail is actually really interesting. I think you see this in Hollywood as well, that people of color and women usually get one opportunity to fail, whereas other folks, they get multiple opportunities to fail, and it's through those failures that you are able to learn. But if you know that the cost of not being successful or failing is higher for you, then you're gonna do the investment that it takes to make sure that you don't fail, or that you fail as few times as possible. So I think it's related to that.
Oh, interesting. I want to ask you about...
She actually did have an explanation for that. You literally have an explanation for everything, don't you, Judith?
I don't.
Judith went to school at every place you want to go to school at. Her story, we talked once, is amazing. We should probably get into that at some point. But I want to ask you about unconscious bias training. Is that what
bias.
It is? Bias training. Would I say bias? That's not a word. Unconscious bias training. That's a lot of syllables. How do you conquer something that's evolutionarily placed in, like...
So the interesting thing about unconscious bias is you can think about it as a processing error. And what I mean by that is, if I were to give you a set of numbers, two really large numbers, and ask you to multiply them in your head, and then give you another set of two really large numbers and ask you to divide them in your head at the same time, it's not something that you can do. We can't process data in that way.
Right.
So similarly, when your unconscious biases are firing, you're unable to actually correct for the bias. We don't have the capability. It's actually a structural limitation of the way we process data.
Right.
However,
with her right now.
I'm so proud of you.
I'm actually with her. This is incredible.
Someone else can see your bias as it's acting. So if we're thinking about how decisions get made, working in groups and empowering folks to call out the biases when they see them, creating an open culture where you have a language to call out bias is very important.
Okay.
Another thing that we know is that there are certain times when bias is more likely. So usually when the stakes are higher, if we're rushed, if we're stressed. So knowing that, then thinking about when decisions get made so that you're not primed for bias.
Okay.
The other thing we can think about is having structure and criteria ahead of time. So thinking about the process for whatever decision is going to be made and say, we know that when this happens, we are more likely to choose someone of this group.
Right.
So we're going to do things like blind resume reviews. I was actually just reading about Samantha Bee and the process for her writer's room, which I thought was really great. You had with John Oliver, with his writer's room, they did double blind submissions so that they had no idea the names or of any of the writers until they decided who they would select for the writer's room. Samantha Bee went one step further in her writer's room. Not only did they do that, they also sent each of the potential writers a very detailed packet so they understood exactly the format that the jokes should come in. So what that corrects for is not only your gender, your ethnicity, your background, but also your level of experience, and allows you to show, are you able to write a good joke or not? So again, creating structures that are already thinking about where bias plays out and removes the decision point so that bias doesn't play into it.
Right. No, I'm trying to process that part go ahead if you have a question.
No, I'm fascinated by the language aspect of groups and how you create an environment where people can call out biases by creating language. Can you give an example of the kind of language that someone could use?
to call out bias? Because I'm just so I can further understand that.
So part of it is an agreement as a team to say, right, to understand these are what our unconscious biases are. This is what they look like. So, for example, a really common bias is a similarity bias or a like me bias. We all have a preference for people who are like us.
I love people like me. They're my favorite people, people like me.
It's true for most of us. It's very human,
everyone
right?
Everyone should love people like me.
Everyone should. but what you can do is if we know that that's going to play out, and I think about it when I review resumes, if I look at your resume and you went to the same college that I went to, I get really excited. I have a certain nostalgia, positive feeling for my college that I then project onto that person. It's that perception that that person's like me. There might not be anything like me. And honestly, there were certainly people that I went to college with that I didn't particularly like. So if that is my single rubric, I've got to think again. So knowing that, I remind myself that whenever I see someone who went to my alma mater, I have to be extra careful to look at what are the criteria for whatever job or whatever role that I'm hiring for, right? So having that kind of language so that if we're in a room and we're talking about a candidate or we're talking about someone, someone can say, hey, that sounds like me bias. Then we all know what that means.
Here's what I like about this is it's not, because this is what I always used to talk about, people stereotyping. It's unconscious. It's a survival technique that we use mm-hmm. to process data, to use your words quicker. So what I like about this is you don't have to put any onus on you. Someone else can notice it and be like, hey, man, you're doing this thing out of this unconscious thing. And it's not like shamed or like, mm-hmm. how dare you? Because that's what I always used to say about it. It's not, we can't be aware of like stereotyping is something we do just because it's quicker to judge. And that's mm-hmm. how we process data better. And
right, like it's a shorthand.
Yeah, exactly, shorthand. Yeah. And I like that this is like a third-party person can be like, hey, man, not a big deal. No shame behind it. Arjun always talks about not shaming this kind of thing. Not shaming it, you're doing it.
Right, and creating and having that openness to feedback is important. And I think what unconscious bias does is it lets us talk about it without it being about blame.
Right.
Right. So we don't have to blame and shame. We can just say, look, we agree as human beings, we all have these unconscious biases. We all fall into them at different times. So pointing them out is important. That's how we help ourselves get better.
Why is this not, this feels like this is important for not just corporations, but like all people.
Agreed.
How do we make that happen? That's not a real question. It was just a response I'm having in this moment to like, I feel like this should be taught in school.
Yeah, I think part of it is the not shaming aspect of it. That's why I was saying that's so cool is like, there's this thing where if someone stereotypes, you just like kind of shout down at them. And that's something I think we've both been kind of like put off by. And this is not, it removes that. It just understands this is a human process.
Right, but that still goes. I just feel like this should be everywhere. This is really, that's all I'm saying. It should be in school.
Well,
Judith,
I think
quit Dropbox, run for president, and make this a part of your platform.
So I don't know that running for president looks very attractive to me right now.
Right, that's fair.
You can imagine. I know that there are folks in the White House who are thinking about these things. Megan Smith, who is the CTO of the United States.
Of course she knows who in the White House is thinking about these things. Of course she knows exactly who is doing it.
She's very concerned about unconscious bias. She has experts on her team who are thinking about it, who are helping to drive this conversation as well from a technology perspective, and also in Hollywood as well, because one of the profound things about Hollywood is that it creates an imagination for a lot of us. And there's something called the CSI effect, where after seeing all of these shows about a forensic science where women were successful in forensic science, the enrollment, especially the female enrollment in forensic science programs, actually went through the roof. And so changing representation actually can have a real impact on that, you know, 24-25% of young women who go into computer science.
Right.
So we're thinking about that. We're having those conversations as well to say, you know, as we are expanding access to computer science education, how are we changing the images that we see? Because that also helps repattern our unconscious biases. Another thing that changes our unconscious biases is an exposure to different types of images. The more that we are exposed to different people, the less likely we are to stereotype them. Because instead of having that default picture being the stereotype, my default becomes, oh, this person that I know. And it changes the way that I interact.
I have this theory that the part of the reason that gay rights has been able to move more quickly and progress more quickly because it's you it's hard. You might know somebody in your family. There's so many people around you, and it transcends our boundaries of separation more easily than race or gender.
I actually thought Hollywood had a big part to do with that. Like, so many more shows that we like have gay characters that we like, and it's like, okay, this is fine. If you're a young kid watching Modern Family, you're like, oh, being a gay couple is not a big deal. Whereas we didn't have that growing up.
Yeah, so it speaks to, I guess, both the things.
Right. Yeah, I think when, you know, we change the image of what family means, and I think that when one of the reasons why marriage equality was so successful was because of that focus on the family. And the family, for most of us, that's the first social unit that we all participate in. And so we can identify with families. And by showing that gay families, lesbian families, bi families, these are families that have the same types of dynamics that the rest of us have, the same types of loves and hopes and dreams, that's very effective, right? It's that humanizing. It's that connection that can make a real difference.
Now, you used to be a teacher.
I was a college professor, yes, and a teacher.
A college professor and a teacher. And now you are doing this.
Yes.
Can you talk to, was there something that disillusioned you about those fields and moved you in a completely different direction? Were you just looking for a change? I'm wondering if this diverse, like, you're so informed about this and obviously very passionate about it. I don't think you can do it without that. Was that something that just moved you or?
Yeah, I think that I've always had a fundamental commitment to fairness and a real passion for social justice, even before I knew that social justice was a thing.
Can you pinpoint where that originated from? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, you know, I think that's really hard because I think even as a child, I just wanted things to be fair. Mm-hmm. And when things weren't fair...
Was that something you were taught?
Did you feel like things were unfair for you growing up, or did you see unfairness that bothered you in someone else?
I imagine I saw unfairness all the time. You know, kids can be incredibly unfair to one another. And I think I was like the weird smart kid on the playground, and I was like, that's not fair. Right. And so, maybe it comes from that. And I think that the work that I do now is still very much rooted in that fundamental sense of fairness. Mm-hmm. I think I've been very fortunate and very privileged. And when I think about privilege, I think about it in terms of, you know, I was raised by my grandparents. My grandparents are immigrants from Jamaica, and they had this perspective that you put your head down, you work really hard, and anything is possible. And I think a lot of immigrant families do that. And it's, they drive their kids and their grandchildren really hard. It is the American dream. And there have been great outcomes. But as I've gotten older, one of the things that I realize is that while the distribution of intelligence is wide, the distribution of opportunity is not the same. And that there are structural inequities in the society in which we live, such that for certain groups, that type of perseverance hasn't led to the same outcomes. And I think it was a growing awareness of that that has also driven some of the work that I do.
So you left teaching.
Yes.
The exact words I think you told me were, doing what I love didn't make me happy, so I decided to make as much money as possible, and that would make me happy.
Yes.
Yeah, I put that out there. I didn't know if that was private information, but whatever, bro. We'll just argue later. But the point is, you still went into something that is, you are very passionate about. Did you enter the workforce just to enter the work, or were you like, this is something I see I could do that I like, and it'll pay me money, let's do it?
No, I wasn't that directed, actually. It was, I had been teaching, I wasn't, and the calculus I made when I was teaching at a university.
The calculus I made, that ain't a verb, right?
And I was desperately unhappy with my work, and I thought to myself, I said, look, if I get another job and I make more money, it doesn't matter if I'm unhappy or not, because that's a net gain. Because now I'm unhappy and I don't make a lot of money. And if I make more money, I will. And
the PSA for teachers, guys. The PSA for teachers.
It makes some. Teaching is fulfilling for some people. It was not a fulfilling job for me. And so I was just looking to be as close to where they invent the money as possible. That was my goal.
I remember that term. What an ill term that is. Invent the money.
And I think in tech, yeah, we are certainly, you know, as I said, inventing the future, inventing the technology that drives a lot of our economy. And that was great. And to be able to find something within this space that also animates that sense of purpose that I have, I think that was fortuitous. It wasn't directed in the, I found my way here, but I wasn't like, yeah, that's that thing. And I just went to my college reunion, and there is no way when I graduated from college that I could have thought, oh yeah, that's the job that I will be doing in the next 15 or 20 years. I couldn't have imagined it.
I'm going to get spiritual for a second. It feels like you allowed for what was the right thing to fall into place. It sounds like there's very much strong alignment between this and what you were trying to do. And so it makes sense, actually, in a lot of ways. We don't have a ton of time left with you. And normally we would have a topic to close it with, but you are smarter than us. So I feel like we should open the space. Is there something that you would like to close with? And if not, Akash has more questions.
I got 5 minutes of stand-up comedy. Let's go.
5 minutes of stand-up comedy. No, I would like to hear Akash's questions. No. Where no, is 5 minutes of stand-up comedy?
Well, this was the question was about actually the podcast salon. Mm-hmm. And I think just bringing it down to like where that came from and how that came about and mm-hmm. your experience with it. Because it was such a cool, I mean, it was obviously an incredibly exciting opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. And just an amazing platform that you guys created. And so it was more of just like, how did it... What's the story behind that?
So it started out as our events marketing team had the idea to just host one podcast, which was Song Exploder. And I was like, that's really cool. Would you be open to making it bigger? And they were like, well, what do you mean bigger? And I said, well, I think we could create a platform where we have podcasters from a variety of backgrounds, and they would all podcast from our space. And we would create a different type of vision of what creative expression looks like. And at South by Southwest, you don't necessarily see a lot of diversity in the types of panelists and people who are represented. And I think it's really important because, again, I want to make sure that we're thinking about a future, that we're thinking about art for everyone. And so I wanted to create that kind of space. And so I didn't want to say the theme of our podcast salon was diversity. I wanted to show the diversity that exists among creative people and the different podcasters that were doing really exciting things. And so I was able to get our team behind that and to get the resources to make it happen. And I think it went really well. I was really excited to just see you and all of the other podcasters come out for it.
There was a ton of people there too. I mean, the audience yeah. seemed to really respond. And I think yeah. that's something that, you know, it seems to be a fight that advocates for diversity seem to have is that diversity sometimes feels like a niche audience. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, like, everyone was there. Like, right. There were really packed houses there. Actually, and I, as you were talking about it, never once in the marketing or anything was diversity mentioned. It was just, mm-hmm. this was a podcast salon, and it just happened to be that everyone, and I don't even know if the audience would be aware that was a conscious intention behind you. Was the idea to leave out diversity in the marketing of the actual event a conscious decision?
Yes. Because I don't think you have to market diversity. I think that diversity is embedded and it's part of it. And it's part of, for me, diversity drives innovation. Diversity drives creativity. Diversity makes a huge difference. And so if you can just showcase a range of creative people, the diversity message is there.
I mean, I got nothing.
That's how we ended.
I had nothing. Listen, how do people learn from you?
She knows everything about everything.
I don't know if I know anything about everything. I think in addition to a commitment to fairness, I just have an incredible commitment to knowledge. And if I don't know something, I try to figure out how I can learn about it.
I'm
if
very
I have
comfortable
to
not knowing. Extremely.
We're all aware. But are you a tweeter? Is that
I am a tweeter. I am Judith M. Williams and I try to tweet with some regularity, usually about topics of gender, equity, diversity, employment fairness.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. or letting us come to you so that you can be on the show. Oh, I should say, we're in, did I say that we're in the Dropbox offices?
I don't know. Did you tell them we got free food and I'm getting more?
I didn't. Okay. It's a it's a beautiful office building.
Fuck the Google offices, people. This is where we need to be. You want a job, you come to Dropbox.
Okay, we're editing.
You got a pastry chef.
All right. Guys, we're coming at you next week with another episode. Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah, guys. Hey, if you don't mind, we are trying to spread the word about this podcast. And one of the ways to do that is if you take your stupid fucking fingers and you move the mouse to the 5-star rating on iTunes and you click it. It's not hard, idiots.
I'm coming in with the good cop here. Lord, it's hard after that one today. You're on some next level shit today. But truly, he's right. We are trying to build a community, and the more that you guys share helps us out. And our Facebook posts that we're putting out, you can share it. That's one way to help us. You can like the Facebook page. You can retweet when we tweet about the new episodes. And in general, just, you know, we want to hear from you, so keep writing to us and all that sort of jazz. We're coming back next week with some more amazing content. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you next week.
God bless.